This is episode 52 of the Next Year Now podcast.
Hi, I'm Gianna Biscantini, a board-certified behavior analyst. If your work and life has become a daily grind and you want to finally create the life you dream of, then you need to start listening to the Next Year Now podcast with my friend, Tom Hefner.
There was this fear factor that if I paid for you to go take this course, you're then going to leave and take what you've learned and the new company will benefit from it. But in fact, the opposite was shown to be true.
Welcome to the Next Year Now podcast with Tom Hefner. Tom believes that if you really want to thrive at work and in life, then every day purposeful habits and practices are vital. The Next Year Now podcast will not only help you identify and integrate these habits into your daily life, but also bring you key insights and lessons from some of the most successful people in their fields. And here is your host, Tom Hefner.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast devoted to helping you thrive at work and in life. The topic of habits and practices is always front and center in our discussion, but we also explore how we use these habits and practices to improve our personal development, productivity, creativity, health and well-being, business and entrepreneurship. We are so fortunate today to speak with Erica Keswin, a workplace strategist, business coach, and author of the just-released book, Bring Your Human to Work. In our conversation, I ask Erica to discuss what it means to bring your human to work, how we can connect more deeply at work and in meetings, how we can design our physical workspaces to cultivate more human connection, book recommendations to help us prioritize what's important for us at work and in life, and so much more. Erica Keswin is a workplace strategist who has worked for the past 20 years with some of the most iconic brands in the world as a consultant, a speaker, writer, and professional dot connector. Her book, Bring Your Human to Work, 10 Surefire Ways to Design a Workplace That is Good for People, Great for Business, and Just Might Change the World, will be published by McGraw-Hill in the fall of 2018. Keswin is also the founder of the Spaghetti Project. You should really check this out. This is really cool. It's a platform devoted to sharing the science and stories of relationships at work. Erica, thank you for joining us today and welcome to the show, my friend.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You know, here's something I want to share with you all that I find really interesting and directly connected to Erica's book. I fly a lot for work, and when I do, the thing that sticks out to me the most is how many people are glued to their phone, their iPad, or even their computer. I look around when I sit down at the gate, and it's heads down. Same thing once I get on the plane, and it's not just at airports. I'm seeing people glued to their phones and devices when they're out with their families, which that's just really sad, and even in the workplace. And that's not a good thing, because if you look at the data and research on well-being, you'll find that most of it can be summed up in three words. Other people matter. Relationships matter. And that's why I love Erica's new book, Bring Your Human to Work. This book is all about helping us to connect in the workplace again. And really, a lot of her ideas can apply to our lives outside of work as well. I know you're excited to jump into this conversation. I am too. That's why we're here. So let's just dive into this. Erica, talk if you would about what led you to pursue this topic of research and why you decided to write this book.
Sure. So when you did my introduction and said I was a professional dot connector, you know, people are probably wondering what on earth does that even mean? So I would say, you know, I have always been a connector. If you talk to people who knew me in middle school, in high school, college, business school, and said, what is one word you would use to best describe Erica, it would be a connector. You know, I was just born and really enjoy, you know, connecting great people with other great people with great ideas. I even did this for a living working at Russell Reynolds as an executive recruiter, connecting great people with great jobs. So it's just in my blood. And as an aside, I've even set up three marriages and have that under my belt. So with that as a background and really seeing the value in relationships and connection, I started to get a little alarmed as technology was becoming more and more prevalent in our lives. And, you know, a funny anecdote, I remember when I first got my phone, my BlackBerry, which dates me, however, my fiance, now husband, had a conference in Bermuda. And I got to go with him and sit on the beach and work with this new device and see him at night. And I thought, this is amazing. You know, I said, and I remember sitting on the beach saying to myself, this is the life. Fast forward 10 years, I'm walking around with a BlackBerry and an iPhone, because for those of us who had BlackBerries, it was just such a great phone, but didn't have the apps that the iPhone had. So I had two. And then I remember saying to myself, in contrast, I cannot believe this is my life. And even then began to think about what I call finding that sweet spot between leveraging what's phenomenal about technology, and there are a lot of good things, but also make sure we remember where, how, and when to put it in its place. So that's how I got interested in this topic. You know, as a workplace strategist and being in the human capital field, my job was to help companies improve their performance through people. But I began to see these big changes, starting with myself trying to juggle these two phones. So I began this, you know, 7-year journey on really studying the impact of technology on connections and relationships at work.
Well, look, I want to go back to probably a more foundational question about your book and bring your human to work. What does it mean to bring your human to work?
To me, bringing your human to work, if I were to narrow it down to one phrase, it's about honoring relationships. And that means honoring relationships with your colleagues, with your customers, with the people that work for you, but even honoring relationships with yourself. And one question that I ask people when I'm working with them is, does your calendar reflect your values? And everybody pauses when they hear that question. We need to really look at how we are spending our time and how much of it is on technology, how much of it is on the phone or actually getting on a plane or connecting with someone face to face. And honoring relationships is being more intentional about how we connect.
I always say nothing kind of replaces that in-person face-to-face conversation. You know, we have a lot of things like FaceTime and other video conferencing, but that face to face, being intentional about when you can have those moments is really important.
One of the things I often say, you know, sort of excusing the cheesy pun, but it's left to our own devices, we're not connecting. And so it becomes more and more important. You know, we've all been situations where the day goes by, you've sent out 700 emails. And then you look back and say, but did I move my goals forward? You know, what am I trying to achieve? You know, we get a hit of dopamine every time we send out an email. So it feels good in our bodies and we're cranking and we feel so productive. But oftentimes when we really look at it, we haven't gotten anything done because oftentimes business needs connection, needs human relationships to move the needle.
Mm-hmm. Erica, one of the constant battles I face with my oldest son, and you have kids, so I think you'll appreciate this, is his periodic request to get his own iPhone. And, you know, I think 75% of his classmates have a smartphone of some sort. And I've resisted because I've seen a lot of his friends just glued to their phones and iPads. And I don't like that. I don't want that for him. But I also recognize that kind of puts me in the curmudgeonly old man camp, and that at some point he's going to have a phone, right? This is the world we live in, the technology that we use to work and play, etc. So, you know, what are some habits and practices that we can all cultivate to leverage technology like smartphones or whatever that may be in the future and connect with each other at home and at work?
Well, it's a great question, and I do believe that much of what we're talking about, we can use whether we're talking about our professional lives and our personal lives. So the image that kept coming to my mind as I was interviewing people for this book was that of the Wild West and a sheriff, because we forget that this technology is relatively new. The iPhone has only been around for 10 years. So I don't know if your son is 10, but you know, how much would you entrust to a 10-year-old child, right? I mean, this is new. And because it's the Wild West, most people don't know what to do. So when we have something like the Wild West, we need a sheriff to help provide rules of the road, to provide guidelines. So you or your partner could be the sheriff in your home, the leader, the manager, somebody running the meeting is that sheriff at work. And we combine that with left to our own devices, everybody's going to have one. And people don't realize it, but they do want structure and boundaries and rules of the road. So in terms of your son, and I struggle with this all the time with my own kids, you can think about everything from maybe they get the device, and it depends on the age, for a certain number of hours, for maybe there are certain rooms in the house where they're never allowed, like their bedrooms, mm-hmm. like the kitchen where you're having family meals. I actually have something that I've been using for the last year, and my son, like many kids out there, many boys especially, are addicted to Fortnite. And I'm sure they'll be the next game or the next Fortnite. And it is ripping families apart. This game is so addictive. So I found an app, and you're going to laugh. In some sense, this may seem so counterintuitive. I am using technology. I am leveraging technology to manage my son's technology, whatever works. So I found this app, and I'm sure there are other ones like it, called Our Pact. So OurPact. And you can download it, and I can be anywhere in the world, and I can remotely shut off Fortnite or really any of my son's apps. So I can set a schedule. So I'm still the bad guy, like Oz behind the curtain. But for example, my son is 13, and he should not have his device beeping during his homework. Why? Because it reduces the quality and the substance of his homework. For every task we add, it reduces the quality of our work by 20%. And if you're in the zone reading something, working on a spreadsheet, and you get interrupted, it takes on average 23 minutes to get back in the zone. So I try to explain to him that having your phone on when you're doing your homework is a lose-lose. Your grades are going to be worse, and it's going to take you twice as long. And so he may believe me, but he may not listen to me. So technology, I can set it so it sort of forces some of those habits. So I think it's a combination. And these same things are used for meetings in the office. I love when companies tell me that they have a no technology rule, that they have everybody put them in a basket or take them out during the last 15 minutes. And what people find is that they enjoy the meetings more. They are much deeper, again, in terms of substance, because you're not constantly getting interrupted. And from a productivity standpoint, a 60-minute meeting, you probably only need 40 minutes.
Well, and it's also the thing I like about it is it becomes a much more respectful meeting and conversation, where there's nothing worse when you're in a meeting and you're trying to communicate something and somebody's clickety clacking or somebody's banging out an email. I think that just hopefully encourages a little bit, whether they realize it or not. There's a respect level that rises up when you do that.
100%. I mean, talk about honoring relationships. I mean, that is the antithesis. It hurts relationships. And one story that I can share is, I was interviewing a company. It happened to be a law firm. And they have a monthly meeting with the most senior people, so the head of the firm and all of his direct reports. And one of the partners, senior partners, told me that the head of the firm has a rule. When he's giving his talk, there's no technology. But the minute he ends, everybody takes it out. So the partner was telling me that, we all know, with law firms, so much of your how you're measured is, if you're a rainmaker, are you bringing in business, your billable hours? But many times as a senior person, you're also doing, you know, other kinds of work that is not measured in the same way. So you're working on recruiting, or you're working on diversity and inclusion, you're working on, you know, other types of issues. And this partner was sharing that, you know, she delivered this big presentation and had spent a lot of hours on it, and everybody was looking down and she was pissed.
Rightfully so.
I don't blame her.
Well, let's look at the flip side of this challenge. We have all this technology. We have it at work. We have it in our personal lives. How can we fully disconnect from work and technology in a world that's 24/7, it's digital, it's, you know, the crazy town at times? How can we disconnect?
It's hard. And from a work perspective, this starts with leadership, because if the leaders never disconnect, no one else will. If the leaders don't engage in conversations about what's expected, no one will ever disconnect. So as an example, one manager that I met with said she brings her group together and says to them, okay, team, I just want you to know that I have three kids and I am not on email between 6 and 9. If you need me, again, this is not disconnecting altogether, mm-hmm. but even just not being tied to your email. I mean, even that gives you a sense of relief. So she says, I want you to know during these hours, if it's an emergency, you can call me, you know, but hardly anybody does. And she said, but even more importantly, because she's the leader, she then says to her team, and then at 10 o'clock, I get back on, but I want you to know that unless I've had a prior conversation with you, that there's some mission critical project that I need you to work on, I don't want you checking your email at 10, 11, or 12 o'clock at night. And just by having these conversations gives people permission to disconnect. And sadly, without it, no one will. And then you get into a position where people are burning out. You know, millennials and Gen Z want to work hard, but they don't want to work all the time. And that leads to turnover, which is bad for business. Mm-hmm. So coming up with these protocols and ideas around disconnection are good for people and good for business. And there's one story in the book that you probably saw, which is from a company called Vynamic, which is a healthcare consulting firm. And the reason why I include Vynamic, and I come from consulting. Consulting is an industry where no one ever thought that they could disconnect. It's driven by client service, and you need to always be on, you need to be on a plane. And Dan Calista, who's the CEO of Vynamic, he used to work at a larger consulting firm and really got burnt out and said to himself, there has got to be a better way. Like it shouldn't have to be like this. So he started Vynamic with the goal of it being one of the healthiest companies in the world. And there's so many different fun anecdotes I can share, but the one that's most related to our conversation right now is that he has a program called Z-Mail, Z-Z-Z-Mail, as in catch some Z's. And it is a company-wide program that says, unless you are working on something mission critical, do not send an email after 10 p.m. or before 6 a.m. and don't send them on the weekends. And then the corollary, which I loved even more, was, and, you know, don't be the jerk that sends what they call the Z-bomb at 9:55. Be more thoughtful. Be more intentional. Be more human.
I love that. I want to go back to something you were just talking about, in meetings, and because it's important. I think no matter who you are, or where you work, inevitably you're going to experience something that I've never really enjoyed, and that is meetings. My experience with meetings, I don't want to say it's mostly negative, but I've had a lot of bad experiences there. Wasted time, wasted not being respectful, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe I'm in the minority here with this, but I suspect that most of us, at least at some point, have had a poor meeting or two, or probably a lot more. So, a couple questions. What effect do meetings have on our connection and relationships in the workplace?
Meetings are it's so important to think strategically about meetings, because they provide huge opportunities for positive connection. I mean, what better opportunity? To your point, in many, many cases, they are run so poorly. People are on technology and not honoring those relationships that it ends up happening, you know, having the adverse effect. What I would also say, it's a numbers game. We are sitting in way too many meetings. And I talk to people that literally get to the office, they have meetings every hour on the hour, and then they can't even start their quote unquote real work until 6 o'clock. When it quiets down. And then people wonder why their turnover is so high. So the way I advise approaching meetings, I break it down into three steps. The first is purpose. Push yourself to look at your meetings over the course of a week. What is the purpose behind these meetings? If you're the leader and if you're calling the meetings, or if you are an attendee and you're going to the meeting, was it helpful? Did you get the results you wanted? Did you really need to be there? And guaranteed, if you do this exercise of trying to articulate what the purpose is and seeing if it fits with your goals, personally and professionally, you can probably cut out 20% of those meetings. The second is presence. And when I think about presence, as we know, being physically present and being psychologically, mentally present are two very different things. And I would urge leaders who are calling these meetings to think long and hard about having some protocols in your meetings to get people to use that time to connect with each other. So, you know, obviously there's the putting the phones in the basket that we talked about. You could do something where each week someone on the team is assigned to run the meeting, to be the greeter, get there 5 minutes early and engage people in conversation, in small talk, get people off their devices and get them connecting. And, you know, this also links to bottom line results. If you're aware of the Gallup study that shows that when you have a best friend at work, you are 7 times more engaged at work and much less likely to leave. When you look at that study and say, best friend, what does that mean? That means that people are talking about things that are non-work related. They are bringing their human to work. So think about ways, you know, maybe in the beginning of a meeting, you can go around and ask everybody a question, you know, even something silly. At Eileen Fisher, they actually, before every meeting, ring a chime. That's almost a meditative approach to ensuring that people are present and getting out of whatever they were doing 5 minutes before and be ready to engage in this meeting. So that's the second P. And the third are our protocols. And to really think as a meeting leader, how do you want this meeting to run? And one of my favorite examples, which is in the book, on which the chapter is called Mind Your Meetings, even just that title, you know, it invites people to be more mindful, to think about these meetings from a more human perspective, is Todd Yellen, who's the Senior Vice President of Product Strategy at Netflix. And, you know, who wouldn't want to sit in, you know, on a hot company like Netflix on their product strategy meeting? So what Todd does is first he democratizes the process and says, you know what, anybody can come to my meetings. You don't have to be in a group, anything related to product strategy. If you want to come to this meeting, great, but you have to follow these rules of the road. So number one, you have to do the pre-reading and know what we're going to talk about. Number two is the no wallflower rule. So if you are going to come, you have to participate. So you can't just come in there and sit and listen. We want you to be actively participating. And rule number three, no phoning it in. You know, you have to be there in person.
I like that little add-on.
And one of my favorite parts about this is there's an agenda. So people know it's a long meeting. People know, you know, you're speaking at 11, I'm speaking at 11:30, that he invites people, every couple of speakers or topics, they take a break. He invites people if the next few topics are not related to you, please leave. I mean, we've all been in those meetings. Maybe these were some of the ones that you were referring to when you started talking about meetings, where you feel like you're stuck. You're stuck in this room. You're probably texting under the table and you're dying to get up, but you feel like it's rude to get up. Can I get up in the middle? This has nothing to do with me. He doesn't want you in this meeting. And from a Netflix business performance perspective, why would anybody want you sitting in even a part of a meeting that was unrelated to you, where you could be doing something else and adding much more value? So Todd approaches these meetings, again, back to the sheriff. These are the guidelines. And I not only interviewed Todd, but I interviewed a couple of people who are attendees in Todd's meeting. And they love it. They say that the data is right. These meetings go so much deeper and people feel so much more engaged because they've done the pre-reading. They know that they're expected to participate. They want to be there and they're supposed to be there.
I really love the idea of the pre-reading, because there's one of the things that's frustrating that I've seen a lot of, both, you know, in my organization and just chatting with friends from college, is the idea that you show up for a meeting and inevitably there's one, two, sometimes three people that are like, okay, so why are we here? And what are we going to do? And they're not up to date on it. They're not up to date on the problem or the actions that have been taken. And there's nothing more frustrating than that.
Well, yeah. And for here, it's harder to get away with it because, I mean, you could say that out loud, but most people have their phones. So in the first 10 minutes, they're pulling up the document because they haven't done the pre-work. The other part that I really love about this, and it goes back to the idea of how do we leverage technology for connection? Again, this is not anti-technology, but let's use it in a really smart way. What he says to people is that, look, I want everybody's ideas as part of my product strategy group. So if you can't be there in person because you're traveling, if you don't want to actively participate, you can go on the Google Doc and you can add in your ideas and your voice in a different way. I just don't want you in the meeting.
Erica, the physical spaces that we have meetings, the physical spaces that we operate in, they play a huge role in our work. I've experienced a wide range of spaces at work. So I've had my own office. That's pretty awesome. I've had an office mate, as we call them. We've doubled up in one office where we each have a desk and a bookcase and all that kind of good stuff. I've worked in an open collaborative space. I've even had a hoteling space at work. Mm-hmm. Talk, if you would, about the role that our workspaces play in curating connection and impacting our work.
Well, I'd boil it down to two words. Space matters. It matters. Our work environment impacts our ability to connect. Now, what I will say, though, is I'm not out there telling companies, you know, especially startups, that they need to be Google or Facebook and spend millions and millions of dollars on a space. And if they can't do that, forget it. There's no chance that their people are going to connect. It is, again, going back to being thoughtful and intentional of how it should be set up, and also how it connects with your values, your business, your goals of your business. So a couple of anecdotes that I can share. You know, one is there are a few companies that I talk to, and Investopedia is one, DoSomething.org is in another, and DoSomething is a not-for-profit. Again, it's not like they have a gazillion dollars to put into this. You know, they have an open space. They have places where you can go for privacy, which is a huge, huge issue. But if you have nowhere to go to connect with yourself and take a call in private, you are much less likely to be engaging in a positive way with other people throughout the day. So I would urge companies to really look at the amount of open space that you have and make sure, especially with companies that are growing at such a fast pace, you want to make sure that there are places where people can go to have that downtime, to have that time for deep thinking and productivity. What you don't want, and I've seen this in interviews that I've done and focus groups, is you don't want people taking days off, vacation days, to work from home because they can't get any work done in the office. You know, it's the antithesis of wanting people and getting people to connect. So I'd say that's the first thing. The second part is to get creative. There's a few companies that talk about what I call mixing it up. Just get people to change seats. It could be every 6 months. It could be every year. And thinking strategically about which groups should sit near which groups. And, you know, there might be group A needs to work with group C. And when they really connect with each other from an innovation standpoint, great things happen. So really getting underneath how work gets done and using the design and where people sit as a way to support those goals. And the third thing I would mention, and you know, this goes back to chapter one, which is called Be Real and how to know who you are, know your values. Some companies talk about even aligning their space, their physical space with who they are as a business and kind of having a rhyme or reason to why your space is designed the way it is. And one fun example of this is Lyft. And one of their four values is create fearlessly. But how can you create fearlessly in just an open office where you can't think straight and get your work done? So the CEO, one of the founders of Lyft, is actually obsessed with Willy Wonka. And in their San Francisco office, they have a secret room with a picture of Willy Wonka on the front with this hidden door. And you go in there and it's a very quiet space, you know, set up like a library. Everybody uses their whisper voice in there. And not only does the space, you know, give people this outlet, but it reconnects people with who Lyft is as a brand and why they do what you do. So, you know, people think about space, where am I going to sit and headcount and different things, but there are ways to design space, use space, communicate about your space in a way that can make your company more human.
Yeah, that tracks with my experience too. I think the one thing I would add is that people often think that there's, you know, some silver bullet, right? There's some amazing solution. And what I've found in designing some innovation and collaborative spaces at our organization is that you almost have to have this hybrid approach to, you know, yeah, you need some, if you need a space where you can have heads down time, you need a space where you can get into flow and really have some deep thought. But then there's times too when you need that collaborative space of like, hey, we're going to be connecting. We're going to be coming up with ideas together, or we're going to be prototyping ideas or whatever that is. So we need that collaborative space. And then sometimes you need some learning spaces where as an individual or as a group of people, where can you go to learn? And then even spaces just being more intentional about like, where can we can just kind of have fun together.
100%.
Erica, I've been very fortunate with professional development. So my employer has a really strong professional development program. They encourage us and support us taking courses or even going back for graduate degrees. They paid for my graduate degree, both my graduate degrees, and one of which was from the University of Pennsylvania. So that wasn't cheap. They offer a lot of coaching and short courses to help us develop specific skills. They advocate and train staff to mentor and coach, and we have really great mentoring programs. But it's interesting. One thing I hear often from younger staff mostly is that they don't have time for these kinds of things. Professional development, it's a luxury, Tom. What's important is doing the work. And in our case, you know, that means doing the technical work. We do a lot of technical work with the DOD, with the military, and they'll say, that's what we're paid to do. We're supposed to do the technical work. We, you know, we don't have time for this professional development. You know, what are they getting wrong about this approach?
Well, what they need to think about and realize is that the world is changing, and millennials and Gen Z, millennials are going to make up 75% of the workforce by 2025. And if we think about the top three things they want in a workplace, they want to work somewhere where there's purpose and meaning. They want flexibility, at least in how they work. And finally, they want to learn on the job, even more than a paycheck. I mean, you need to make, you know, a certain amount of money to be okay, but extra money beyond that is not as big of a motivator for this generation. They want to feel like they are growing and developing. And if they don't get that, they will leave. So it behooves leaders and companies to think more strategically about how to build this in. So one really interesting example is a professional services firm. It's actually an architecture firm in Colorado, where similar to the example of the law firm, you know, many professional services firms, they want to know how many hours you build. They want to know if you are engaged with clients or what they call on the bench. You know, if you're not working with any clients, you're, yep. You know, it's kind of they're dead to you. You know, it's kind of a problem. But what they found in this professional services firm was that, you know, their attrition was up. Everybody was burned out. And they began to interview people and they realized that something had to change. And they actually created a system whereby, you know, they figure out how many hours they want people to work, but those professional service hours count as much as the billable hours. They are built in to the system. So that has to come from the top or it's not going to happen. And someone just has to decide that it's a priority. And yeah, maybe they're billing a few less hours a month, but the cost of turnover of a top person is so incredibly high. You know, a valued employee is so incredibly high that, trust me, the numbers work out in your favor to, you know, not bill as many hours in the short term and play the long game and retain your top people.
Well, I look at my own experience and that tracks because I've been at this organization for almost 15 years. And one of the reasons why I've stayed there is, yeah, the work is really great and rewarding and we get to do some really cool stuff. But I also know that they invest in me and invest in my time to make myself better. I've changed. I tell people all the time, I've reinvented myself like four times at my organization. So, I know anecdotally that makes sense to me too.
Well, you know, what's interesting, there was an article I saw recently that talked about the high percentage of people that will do online courses and don't finish. And then part of it was talking about companies that will pay for someone to take, you know, an online course. And one of the reasons they cite that the companies didn't want to support this was that there was this fear factor that if I pay for you to go take this course, you're then going to leave and take what you've learned and the new company will benefit from it. But in fact, the opposite was shown to be true, that if I'm investing in you, you are much more likely to stay. And so I think companies need to trust the force on that, because the data is showing that without the development, the people are leaving anyway. So you might as well think about ways to provide that for you to be the one to provide those skills, and there'll be a greater chance that they stay.
Before I move on to the last part of our show, what else from your book, Bring Your Human to Work, would you like us to know? And I know when I asked that question, we could probably spend another couple hours and have a really great discussion. But like, what are those kind of key points that we might not have hit on yet?
I would say that the key point that I want to leave the listeners with is that the 10 surefire ways, the 10 chapters in the book are all ways to bring your human to work. And what I tell leaders is that you can pick from a menu of options. They're in no particular order. You can choose ones that resonate more with you because of your industry, your company goals, your growth trajectory, your budget, whether employees are saying that they want to focus on a program where you give back, or are you finding that professional development's a really big issue? So all of that is the case except for one chapter. And chapter one, Be Real, How to Speak in a Human Voice, is first for a reason. And so I want to highlight that, because that Be Real chapter breaks down into three specific parts. One is know who you are, know your values. It's difficult to think about some of the things we've been talking about today from a programmatic perspective if you don't know who you are, what your company stands for, and where you're headed. You know, what are your goals? Because you will likely miss them if they haven't been defined up front. So in that first part of the book, I talk about, you know, mistakes that companies make, like having way too many values so that nobody knows what to focus on. The second part is of being real is to speak an authentic voice. And what I mean there is think about all the different ways that we communicate, from text to email to picking up the phone to walking down the hall to presenting at a town hall to getting on a plane. And all of those mediums are not created equal. But when you think about, once you know who you are and your values, the companies that do this the best are consistent across these different mediums of communication. And the last part is, are your employees empowered to live these values? Because to me, a culture, especially a human culture, can be defined by what happens when the boss isn't looking. You know, you could have all the great values in the world, but when the boss isn't looking, you know, are employees empowered to live them, to bring their human to work? And so I wanted to raise that because I think it's important for people to really dig into that first chapter and assess, you know, many, probably 95, if not 100% of the companies I talk to, let's say 95, have a set of values. You know, I spoke at a conference yesterday. I said, how many of you work for a company that has a set of values? Everybody raises their hand. But in many, many cases, these values are platitudes. They're in a little frame on a desk. They're posted on the wall, but they're not alive. They're not felt in the halls. And to me, if in this journey of creating a human company, it really needs to start there.
Look, it's time for my favorite part of the show. Erica, you've gone through the arduous process of writing a book. So I think you'll appreciate this discussion. This is where we talk about one of the very best habits we can adopt today, and that's the habit of reading. I want you to think about the books you've really enjoyed over the years or books that have impacted you deeply. What are the two or three books that stand out for you?
I'll share the books with a caveat by saying in the last couple of years, as I've been writing my book, I have skewed much more to the nonfiction business books. And one of my goals now that my book is going to come out is to go back and I love to lose myself in a good fiction book. I mean, I don't even reach for my phone if I'm that engaged in a great book. That being said, that has not been my focus. So the books that I will share are nonfiction, but have all impacted me, you know, in a big way in the last few years. So the first, it happens to be a very recent book that I fell in love with called The Art of Gathering by a woman named Priya Parker. And for those listening who are dealing with awful meetings and, you know, some of the, you know, discussions we were having today about just having the life sucked out of you in these meetings, you'll enjoy The Art of Gathering. But what Priya talks about is being thoughtful, being intentional in how you bring people together. You know, and it doesn't have to be a meeting, any type of event. What happens in the beginning? How do you close a great event? I mean, I've been in meetings and events where it's been amazing. And then it sort of ends on okay, it's 5 o'clock and somebody just gets up and then everybody trickles out. Right. And you sort of lose, like you want to end on a high note, which you need to plan for that up front. And so I learned a ton in this book, both in terms of how, you know, when I host a dinner party or think about where people sit, I loved it. The second book that I read recently is by Randy Zuckerberg called Pick Three. And, you know, this is for women and for men. You know, a lot of my girlfriends have read it, but I think it's applicable for men as well. You know, we talk about work-life balance and trying to do it all. It's just not possible, especially in this technology world that we're in, right? Think about the way it used to be. You're a farmer. You start to work and the sun goes down and then you're not working anymore. And so there's a clear delineation between when you're working and when you're not. None of that exists. So what Randy did was she picked five things that most people focus on or are important in their lives: family, friends, work, fitness, and sleep. And what she says is that on a given day, you can only pick three. And what it really has changed my thinking, because part of it is, and you know, sometimes I might sneak in a fourth, or I might get a, you know, a 2-for-1 if I go for a walk with a friend. But it takes some of the guilt away of trying to fit it all in. And especially if I'm not seeing my kids. And again, I was at this conference in Boston yesterday and I missed my son's first day of school for the first time in 13 years.
No.
Yeah, I know. I needed to pick work on that day and lose the guilt about not picking family or saying no to something because I'd been away so much and saying, you know what, this day I'm picking family. And so, you know, I'm all about being intentional and trying to be strategic, and it's not always going to work out. But I think this whole idea of picking three and tomorrow I might pick a different three. And then in the book, she talks about take your calendar over the last month and assess, you know, which three did you pick? And if you see that over the 30 days, you know, every single day work was one of the three, that may be a red flag as well. So it's putting some structure around something that is typically unstructured.
Reminds me of a quote that I just heard recently that says, you can do anything, but you can't do everything.
Exactly.
And just being more mindful and more intentional. And like you said, there's going to be different times, you know, when you're going to be able to prioritize, you know, one of those five or three of those five over the other. And that's okay.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, look, final question. What's next for you that you're really excited about? And I know you have the book launch coming, so that's amazing. But if we look past the book launch, or maybe there's something that's connected with the work that you're doing with the book.
So I'm working on a couple of things. One is Bring Your Human to Work Shops, you know, workshops, or Bring Your Human to Work Shops, with a more fun spin on the name. And I am starting to go into companies to help different parts of an organization bring their human to work, which has been really exciting. And then I'm also starting to do some retreats. I have a space that I use where, you know, sometimes it's hard to get underneath an issue in a company if you're in your own space. It's much better if you can go somewhere else, have a change of venue, which then impacts how you view things. And so my goal is to do two types of Bring Your Human to Work retreats. One is within bringing people together within the same company and have them work together in different ways and really map these 10 ways to bring your human to work to their companies and see what the gaps are. You know, what do they do well? You know, maybe there's a chapter, maybe they don't have anything and it's something that they want, and, you know, send them off at the end of the day with an action plan of where those gaps are. But then also having retreats where there might be different people from different companies that want to come and learn from me, but also learn from each other.
Yeah.
So a way to almost take this book and make the book more human by working together in person with what I call leaders who get it.
Well, look, we're going to have to talk because I for one think that my organization could probably pick up a few of those chapters and integrate them into their organization. Erica, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. I've taken a lot away from this. I know everybody else has as well. So thank you. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You can connect with Erica Keswin online through her website, ericakeswin.com. That's spelled E-R-I-C-A-K-E-S-W-I-N. All the links and resources Erica and I discussed, including a link to her just-released book, How to Bring Your Human to Work, can be found at the page created just for this episode. You'll find it all at nextyearnowpodcast.com/52. And finally, just a reminder, if you love the show, you enjoy learning from our guests each week, please consider giving us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us stay relevant and findable by listeners like you. That's it for today. I'll see you next time.